I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, what will a future beyond the horizon of neoliberal capitalism look like? That's a question that more and more folks are asking as COVID-19, nationwide protests in response to the police killing of George Floyd, and other crises call into question the legitimacy of the current neoliberal order. Isaiah Medina's brand new experimental avant-garde documentary, Inventing the Future, a cinematic adaptation, attempts to give not only a vision of what a potential post-capitalist future could look like, but also what a film from that future would be. Based on a book of the same name by scholars Nick Cernusek and Alex Williams, Inventing the Future delves into ideas like the full automation of the workforce, universal basic income, and a repudiation of the Protestant work ethic, which has continued to flourish under neoliberal capitalism. Austin Hayden of the Owls at Dawn and Show Me the Meaning podcasts joins us to discuss this fascinating documentary, which, full disclosure, he helped produce. In this conversation, we get into some of the main ideas expressed in Inventing the Future, German filmmaker Werner Herzog's concept of an ecstatic truth that can be expressed in cinema, the unusual cinematic trajectory of the legendary French filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard, and much, much more. So, with that being said, let's dive right into the conversation with Austin Hayden on the new documentary, Inventing the Future, a cinematic adaptation. But first, a word from our sponsor.
My name is Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm a journalist who specializes in conspiracy theories and French culture. Over the years, I've met cultists and occultists, flat earthers, and doomsday bunker salesmen, to name only a few. One thing I hear often is that the end of the world is near, and these days, you have to wonder if there might be some truth to that. My new podcast is called Failed State Update. Through interviews and original reporting, each episode asks the question, is the world ending, or does it just seem like it is? Think of it as fresh air for the Orwellian dystopia we've suddenly found ourselves in. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Austin Hayden of the Owls at Dawn podcast, and also producer of the fascinating new, I don't want to just say documentary, I want to say experimental documentary, Inventing the Future. How are you doing, Austin?
Yeah, I'm chilling, man. Thanks for having me on.
So you're all the way in Australia. I'm recording here from the U.S., and it's gotten pretty crazy over here in the past few days with all the protests.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I guess in some ways it feels like I'm disconnected, but because of the immediacy of social media, I'm never too far removed in some ways from the news, at least. So yeah, I wake up most mornings because, you know, there's a massive time difference. It's like 14 hours between us, but I'm from the West Coast and it's a 17 hour time difference right now. So I get a lot of messages throughout the night where I wake up to people asking for if I've been paying attention to the news. And if I have any, I just had some friends today actually, do you have any good like socialist accounts or accounts that I could like follow that are actually covering this from an interesting perspective rather than just the mainstream media and stuff, you know? So even if I were kind of removed, my friends and family and things like that always keep me informed. It's, you know, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. How are things? You're in Philly, right?
Pittsburgh, PA. People always say Pittsburgh. Philly first. I feel like Pittsburgh is not the city people think of when they think of Pennsylvania. It's always Philly.
Which is too bad because I'm a football fan and I love me some Steelers. So, you know, growing up, I was a huge Penguins fan, like the Mario Lemieux. I mean, like, and Jaromir Jagr was just brilliant. So it's unfortunate that my mind does not go to Pittsburgh. So you're in Pittsburgh. How are things there? Are things kicking off or is everybody staying safe? What's the deal?
Everyone's staying safe right now. We're still pretty much in lockdown phase, basically. That may be changing in the middle of June, but overall things are pretty quiet here as opposed to a lot of other cities in the U.S. right now. I know in Australia things have calmed down a lot amidst this coronavirus crisis, or at least that's what I've heard from friends in Australia.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking, too, also just about the protests going on that kicked off in Minneapolis, and I know there have been protests kind of spreading all around the world, but yeah, I mean, shoot, add the other layer of the lockdowns, the global pandemic, and a lot of the economic fallout that's come from that. It's a weird clusterfuck of temporal instances at the moment. In Australia, you know, we didn't get hit hard with the coronavirus. I think we have fewer than 10,000 cases nationwide, reported cases, obviously. And then
I was going to say real quick, I think yeah. Australia is an interesting case because I don't think it followed the Italian curve, which everyone was expecting it to, and it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I hadn't been paying attention to the predictions, but I do know that the last I checked just a couple of days ago, we had 102 attributable deaths, which is, you know, nothing compared to the over 100,000 that you get in the States and the tens of thousands in other places. We didn't have a really high infection rate. I don't know what that's to. It could be a bunch of different contributing factors. You know, they did cease travel and they did like a soft lockdown of the borders pretty early on, stopping people coming from China. They didn't really impose social distancing and lockdown regulation till a bit late in the game. So the ScoMo government got a little bit of shit for that. But it for whatever reason, it could have also been weather dependent. You know, we are coming out of our summer. So now it's starting to get cold here, which is the opposite, obviously, in the Northern Hemisphere, where it was cold when it was hitting like peak numbers. So it could have something to do with that. So that may have some sort of impact moving forward as we move now through our autumn and then into our winter. Maybe this is typical flu season anyway, right? Viruses thrive better in the cold than in the warm weather. And Sydney in particular is a very hot city. And then further north, Queensland's really hot. So, I mean, who knows? There could be a kind of confluence of causes, but Australia seems to have kind of done all right, at least in terms of medically, seems to have done all right.
Well, it's interesting. I think we can use this all as a springboard into the documentary Inventing the Future, which is why I initially contacted you, although I'm also a fan of the Owls at Dawn podcast. But first, I wanted to ask you something. I know on your Twitter account, you have in your description that you're an expat. And I was just interested in your experience as an expat, because I know a lot of people that have been thinking about it a lot more lately. Like maybe I should, you know, try to live in another country, see what it's like there. It seems like that's becoming more and more of a thing for a lot of citizens here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of being playful when I use it because, I don't know, I think everything on social media, there's always like a tinge of self-awareness. It's hard in a post-ironic world to not have some level of self-awareness. But, yeah, I mean, I've been abroad for like 9 years, really. I did move back to LA in like 2014 for about a year and a half. And I was doing some work in the States. But it is an interesting experience. I mean, I don't know. Like when people are like, I'm going to move to Canada, fuck this, I'm out. Like part of me, I get it from an existential perspective. I totally get it. You know, you want to just get out of the madness and it seems that there are greener pastures elsewhere. Right. But then at the same time, there's a lot to be said for not cutting and running and staying and fighting. I didn't cut and run. I went away for school and then I just didn't really return. And then when I did return, it just didn't feel home to me anymore. I was in Europe for like 7-8 years and I went back to LA, which is where I'm from, LA, Orange County. And it just didn't feel home. Maybe if I were in a different city, maybe more of, I don't know, what would you say? I don't want to use the word superficial, but a less superficial city, maybe, mm-hmm. You know, then maybe that would be the case or, I don't know. I don't really know if I would have felt the pull back, but I will say that I'm in no rush at the moment to get back. I'm enjoying, you know, being a citizen of the world, so to speak.
Well, it's become a real moment of crisis in the U.S. with coronavirus, with these protests. I think, you know, the anger, the rage never really goes away, and I can't blame people from marginalized communities in the U.S. for being angry right now. It seems like we're in a moment where people are starting to question maybe, possibly, capitalism a lot more. And that's sort of what Inventing the Future is about. For my listeners that don't know, what is Inventing the Future based on? And how did you become involved with the documentary?
Yeah. I will say, too, I just want to say it's interesting. You talk about the marginalized communities. The luxury that a lot of people have with the option of moving abroad isn't afforded to the majority of Americans, right? So what you get is a deepening of the compression of what I would say are the exploitative anxieties that are induced by the capitalist mode of production that disproportionately affect minority communities, that disproportionately affect peripheral communities, peripheral states, peripheral nations around the world. And it leads to these types of outbursts, right? Because the moments, I guess, become more and more protracted. I'm not a big fan, though, of thinking about crisis moments as being something unique to capital. I actually tend to, in my reading of Marx and of Marxian theory, tend to think of crisis as being endemic to capitalism all the time, at every point. There are always sites of contestation that need to be addressed. It's just that the risk of the system of capital is either exported outside of the center or it's covered over through what Marx refers to as countervailing tendencies, right? So, you know, wage issues have become a problem in the States, right? So what is kind of supplemented that is the expansion of private credit or personal credit. The turn towards the asset economy, people investing in mortgages and things like that to try to kind of mitigate some of those anxieties, right? Now, it doesn't obviously work for everybody because, again, there are a lot of people who are renters and they don't have the option of being able to participate in that asset economy. But nevertheless, there are these tendencies that are oftentimes on offer to give people some sort of pacifying sense that they can endure through the crisis. And that actually gets them to invest in it more, right? It's a pacifying tendency. So I tend to think of it like that. It's always existing. And so I think that kind of fits with, to kind of like wrap this into the film, where the ideology, if you will, of the film comes from is it emerges out of a couple of scholars who wrote a book called Inventing the Future, Post-Capitalism in a World Without Work, who are loosely aligned with, or maybe not so loosely aligned with, they were definitely previously aligned with it. I don't know how much they would wear the moniker now, but with something called left accelerationism. So Nick Cernik
this is
and
Nick
Williams.
Cernisik and Alex Williams. You took the words out of my mouth. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah. And so Nick is Canadian and Alex is English, but they both did PhDs at the London School of Economics in like, I believe it was in like international relations, but their work is really philosophical and You know, Nick is now a professor of like digital humanities, digital economics. He's also wrote a subsequent book called Platform Capitalism, which is really good. I recommend people read that. He's also done some work on care work with Helen Hester and like domestic work and I think like social reproduction theory, that kind of stuff. And then Alex, he is English by birth, I believe, and it definitely has an English accent. And he does, his new book is on like hegemony. So the book project that they kind of started with Inventing the Future has spawned onto these different like kind of projects emerging out of that. But they have been working for years out of this like left accelerationist movement. They drafted the Accelerationist Manifesto and they co-edited the hashtag Accelerate volume together. And so they've kind of already been thinking along these lines of how to confront capitalist crisis as something that maybe you don't use the old Leninist vanguard party that is like the center for revolutionary change, but there's kind of a way, for lack of a better term, to kind of go through capitalism. You know, you go through the production process towards some sort of post-capitalist future that can be realized. And this really derives from particular readings of Marx and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall and organic composition of capital and all that technical shit that I don't know if your listeners need all of that, but it comes from a particular reading of Marx that you can kind of, that there's a way to go through capitalism. And that's really where the book comes from. And then that's where the film is inspired by.
So for listeners that I always assume that I have listeners that are new to these sort of philosophical inquiries.
Yeah.
How would you sum up this idea of working through capitalism and this idea of accelerationism for someone that may be unfamiliar? Although I will admit I've done a few shows on the topic, but I haven't covered the left accelerationism nearly enough.
I mean, I think it really comes down to a debate about where is the outside of capitalism, right? Like, is it labor? Is labor that revolutionary subject of history that allows for the cracks in capitalism to be revealed? And that if labor can just coalesce in the right ways, that it will be able to put enough pressure on the capitalist mode of production by transforming the relations of production as labor becomes the integral force element of the forces of production, then you can kind of transform the socioeconomic system. And then there are other debates that say, well, but that's not really what the outside is. Maybe there is no outside. Maybe the best way to run down the system isn't through the valorization of some trans-historical understanding of labor, that somehow labor is kind of valuable in itself, but rather we understand that actually labor is a participatory, even in its production of use value, is also still part and parcel of the reproduction of the capitalist system. You get this reading in like Moish Postone, for example, right? And a lot of like value form Marxists. So then the ideas will shift. And so what do we do? And so one alternative is this idea of acceleration. Now, acceleration doesn't mean faster and slower necessarily. So a lot of people read acceleration as though it simply means that we just need to consume more and produce more. And they see that as kind of like an intensification of barbarism, right? Especially if you're anti-capitalist. If you're anti-capitalist, then you look at that like, shit, why do we want to like speed up or intensify capitalist production? That's like an intensification of barbarism, an intensification of exploitation, no? Acceleration tries, and I think some readings of acceleration definitely do echo that. I think that the one provided in Inventing the Future, I think the one that Nick and Alex advocate, and definitely the one that the director of Inventing the Future film and then myself advocate, is something kind of alternative. It's more about a qualitative break, if you will, with a particular temporal logic. So if we think about capitalism as operating under a particular like linear, progressive, modern, you know, industrializing type of logic, the notion of acceleration isn't just simply, let's just ramp up production, but it's more about intensifying. So it's about intensity rather than just, let's say, speed. So it's about an intensification, if you will, of the mode of production for the purpose of repurposing the technological landscape, right? So there's already a technological landscape that exists. You know, the various factors of production, also the tendencies for like labor to be converted into an input for capital extraction. So the issue is then about how can we repurpose these inputs so that there's a qualitative shift in how they're oriented in and to the socioeconomic landscape so that new modes of mediation, so that new modes of reciprocity can take place. And that's really, I mean, that's a bit abstract, but the description I think kind of is apt for understanding at least how we try to understand the accelerationist project. It isn't about intensifying exploitation. It's about an intensification of the contradictions more so than anything, which will then hopefully allow us to repurpose tools of technological development, which doesn't just mean like IT and computer technology, right? This isn't just simply like a technological utopianism, but expanding the notion of techne even broader to everything in terms of language, systems of meaning, and systems of reciprocal exchange. And yes, of course, also what we generally think of in terms of technology, like, you know, IT and computers and, you know, the stuff of tools that we tend to think about, but not just limited to that, to everything as well. And I think art is also something that is part of this project. So the film doesn't just speak of how to do something, but is an enactment of a particular type of accelerationist cinema, where the film itself utilizes certain formal capacities and what we think are qualitatively unique modes of presentation that speak of a different arrangement, if you will, under capital, that we would think, at least speculatively, tries to hint at a type of post-cinematic post-capitalist cinematic language.
I'd be really interested into digging into that more. I felt like watching Inventing the Future, I was reminded of a lot of the early experimental cinema of the 20th century. I kept thinking about, for some reason, I'm not saying it's necessarily very similar to it, but it sort of reminded me of Maya Deren, Meshes of the Afternoon. I'm wondering, what do you think the big influences were for you and I guess the director, Isaiah?
Yeah, so I mean, it's probably would be good for me to just give a brief history of how the project came about. I read the book Inventing the Future in 2015, and I kind of grew up working in the entertainment industry as, I grew up in front of the camera, and then I kind of slowly transitioned behind the camera at a certain point. And I was working at a production company in LA as a producer and doing some work in editing too. But I was working on like documentaries and shit like that, but it just all rang very hollow to me. And I had gone through grad school and I was figuring out ways to try to wed together my philosophical and political economic interests with my artistic and cinematic interests, right? And so I ended up quitting that job as a producer and through the kind of course of study over the next like year or so, I ended up reading Inventing the Future. And as I was reading it, I said, this needs to be made into a fucking documentary. And they were like, this is it. This is the thing I can do. I can wet together my interest in cinema by making a documentary about a badass book that I think speaks to my political and philosophical interests, right? And so that was the idea. And then I just so happened, like, you know, a couple months after that, to see Isaiah's first film that was called 8888. And I saw it on Mubi, and it caused me to reach out to him. He just had a vision of cinema that I had never seen before. For people who aren't familiar with his work, he is an avant-garde experimental filmmaker who has made quite a name for himself in those circles, and then particularly in the online world among, I guess, what you might call like millennial. I don't know if we can use these generational terms, but among the kind of like millennial filmmaker crowd. And 8888 premiered at Locarno Film Festival, and then it played at TIFF, and then it played New York Film Festival, and it was on a bunch of like end of the year lists for best avant-garde experimental film. And so I was really drawn to what he was doing because it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. He just seemed to be this really unique voice. And so I reached out to him, and he just so happened to be like, dude, I fucking love that book. I would love to be involved in an adaptation of it. And that's really what started it. And then through the course of conversing with him and with Alex and Nick, we kind of figured out that this can't just be a film, like a documentary in the sense of a talking head documentary. Like, it can't just be a film that speaks about a topic. It has to be something that is an enactment, that is an expression. Like, in other words, it's something that Isaiah talked about, especially in the early goings, but even now, like, what would it look like for a film to come from the future? Like, is that even possible? Like, how can we think the future? Because most of the time when we think the future, we're actually foreclosing the radicality of the true future, because we just posit something that is really some sort of reproduction of the past and the present, right? because we're basically just taking all of our sense data and our knowledge of what is present, and we kind of just project it into the future with maybe some modifications, but nevertheless, it's some sort of like abstract projection of the past and the present. But it's like, no, what would it mean to actually do something from the future, to think of the true future itself? And that was the idea, is that we wanted to express something along those lines. And in terms of like the cinematic influences, for people who have seen the film or who are familiar with Isaiah's work, and obviously you know this now, Joe, it's very fast montage-y cuts, right? Now, I think Inventing the Future is less so than 88, and like It Is What It Is, which is another one of Isaiah's projects, and some of his other stuff. And that's, there are some long takes. Like there's a bit where the camera just literally sits on some members of a think tank in the UK for like, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, right? So there are some long extended takes. But he utilizes the cut, and he utilizes montage, which I think we can trace back to Eisenstein.
Yeah, that was very popular among the Soviet filmmakers, I believe, that style. Totally.
Yeah, and Isaiah loves the cut, right? There's a, and I never know if it's an apocryphal quote or if it's a real quote attributed to Godard, where he says, like, the truth is in the shot, the lie is in the cut. And I think Isaiah is also really influenced by Godard. I think you can see elements of like La Chinoise in this film as well. But I think Isaiah would invert that and say, actually, like I don't know if, or maybe not even invert, just a total deconstruction of it, but that there's truth in both and maybe lies in both. But the point is that the cut is something that is radical. You know, to be a thinker of the cut, to theorize the cut, and to give substance to the cut, not as being a manipulation, but as something that is kind of like truthful and part of the cinematic language in a way that doesn't like denigrate it. It's something that Isaiah really wants to work through, right? So yeah, he's definitely influenced by montage cinema. And then of course there's some clips of like the Lumiere brothers as well in the film as well, which is kind of interesting. So yeah, those are kind of the influences. I mean, he's definitely trying to situate this film in the history of cinema, while also then opening up to the future and having it be a film from the future. Because the future would still speak to the past, right? In a type of like reverse causality sense. So I don't think he wants to, it's not like he's shitting on the history of cinema. He's explicitly embedding himself within the history of cinema as a love letter to cinema, but trying to say, what can the cinematic language be from the future?
If I could, it's interesting that you mentioned Godard. I'm a big fan of his work. But I know so many people that say, ah, yes, Weekend, such a beautiful film. But the thing that gets me is people I know will often say, Godard lost his touch as time went on. He doesn't want to make narrative film anymore. I mean, his latest film, which has been described as a horror movie, is a movie called Image Book. I don't know if you had a chance to see that yet. But it sort of has like a montage vibe to it. It's sort of a... a collection of images. I mean, that hence the name. But in a way, I've always felt a certain affinity for why Godard went in that direction, because there's such a limitation to the sort of regular narrative form. I've never understood why Godard's move towards trying to break free of the regular narrative structure upset people so much. Maybe it's because it's too radical. I don't know.
I mean, I think there's also a bit of a stigma that he's French and that there's like this pretension that oftentimes circle people that come out of like the French New Wave, stuff like that. So I think that's probably part of it, is that stigma is attached to Godard's name in general, that he's trying too hard to stick up his middle finger at cinema, right? And maybe there is an element to that. And I kind of don't have a problem when sometimes people want to stick their finger up at the establishment, right? But I think at another level, there is something genuinely authentic. And I think that we should applaud filmmakers for moving into new and unique directions. And we may not like it. Here's the problem. I think that we live in an age of what the philosopher Byung-Chul Han refers to as an age of positivity, of pure positivity, right? I think everything now is pitched at the level of like pleasure or enjoyment. Like you must enjoy everything.
Can I interject there? It's like when people talk about some of these prestige TV shows that have gotten popular and created spinoffs. Breaking Bad comes to mind. Everyone loves Breaking Bad and the spinoffs like Better Call Saul.
Yes.
And also there was just a movie they did, El Camino. And so much of it now just feels like fan service. And to me, that's very limiting because it doesn't allow us to make really confrontational cinema. Like, sometimes I think it's good when a film doesn't give you what you want. It doesn't give you the feast that you're looking for.
I agree. I mean, so I'm the co-host for the Wisecrack. For people who know the YouTube channel Wisecrack, I do their film podcast, Show Me the Meaning, and I also help produce some of the videos for their online content. And we watch popular films. Just the other day, we covered Christopher Nolan's The Prestige. It's a standard narrative Hollywood film. Yeah, it's got a couple of tricks and twists and some jump cuts and things like that, but it's a, you know, it's got all the bits. It's got sexy people, Christian Bale, Hugh Jackman, Scarlett Johansson. I mean, it's got pretty people saying pretty words, telling like a fancy story. It is pleasurable to watch it, right? And I think that's great. I can have a great time with that. I enjoy that movie. I am excited for Christopher Nolan's Tenet. You know, I can watch Jaws, the blockbuster film, the Star Wars films with the rest of them and enjoy them. But at the same time, I don't think that everything needs to be just pitched at the level of pleasure. And I think that there's something about cinema as a language in itself, not using language, not as representational, as in like representing the language of everyday discourse or representing popular discourse or representing the cultural motifs that are in the cultural zeitgeist. But maybe cinematic language can be something transformative in itself, that can be a language in itself that speaks in its own way. And that speaks according to its own logic, which means that maybe then I can start talking in different ways, ways that are uncomfortable or unfamiliar or that are just outside the bounds of the limits that we generally are accustomed to. And then maybe that's not pleasurable. And that's okay. It could still be interesting and intriguing. It could maybe even be quote unquote good. But now we're getting to like, what is film criticism, right? And I think that we just need to open up. Be pluralists. Let's be fucking radical pluralists when it comes to our consumption of art and film and things like that, and our production of those things. So I'm down for Godard's turn in his later life. Like film shows socialisme, come on, I'm down for it. I haven't seen Image Book yet, though.
You know, it's interesting, too, because you just made me think of another filmmaker who I probably like even more than Godard, and he has sort of become very much attached to the documentary form and debates about it. But I'm thinking of Werner Herzog now because he's always had these arguments with, you know, filmmakers like Frederick Wiseman and the people who believe in the cinema verte style. Right. And he's always said, you know, why does a film have to tell like a simple documentary truth in the sense that most people think of it? Like, why can't cinema tell us a poetic truth, or I think he calls it the ecstatic truth.
I love that. I absolutely love that. There was a docuseries that was recently out on Netflix called The Last Dance. I don't know if you're a basketball fan. Did you get caught up in that at all?
No, I haven't seen that. Tell me a little bit more.
So it's about the 97-98 Chicago Bulls team, their final year, right? Where they knew that Phil Jackson, the head coach, wasn't going to be brought back. And so Michael Jordan said that if Jackson's not back, then he wouldn't be back. Scottie Pippen's contract was running out, et cetera, et cetera. They knew that this was it. So the coach basically themed the season when they were in the preseason, the last dance. Like, they knew this was the last thing. They had won 5 championships in the last 7 years. This was it. They were going for the 6th championship, their second three-peat. And the documentary is told really from the perspective of Michael Jordan. Like, he had creative control over the whole thing. And so there was some criticism about whether or not it was an accurate documentary piece, right? Or whether or not it was like distorted and biased. And here's the thing, man. I thought the debate was so silly because all documentary is bias. It's myth. It's myth-telling. I think all expressions of human communication have some level of mythos attached to them. We just aren't often aware of that in a post-Enlightenment sort of kind of like what we think is a totally scientific, rational world. But I think there are elements of myth in everything we're saying. Even the intonation that I'm using now to try to like convey excitement. I mean, I'm genuinely excited. But there's some elements of like theater that are going on here, right? And I think we kind of get that with all human communication. And so for me, the whole debate about whether or not it's a real documentary, like it's an objective piece, or whether or not it's a poetic expression, an artistic expression, to me, kind of misses the boat. And I really like the idea of, if you called it ecstatic kind of documentary, I kind of like that idea, that what we can do with the cinematic language is affect people, transform people, present them a view of the world, not the view of a world, but a view of the world, right? Or a view of a world. And I think that's what's most interesting, is that we're all myth makers here. We're all myth tellers. And that cinema just happens to be a very particular expression within a long tradition of myth telling within human beings. And so I love that. I actually want to lean into that even more than some people. And I want to just go full fucking steam into the process of myth making, you know?
Have you, by any chance, seen, since I mentioned Herzog, have you seen Grizzly Man?
Yeah, loved it.
See, I find it fascinating because I've had people criticize that documentary, and I've had discussions with other people about it, and they'll say, well, obviously this guy was just an adrenaline junkie. That was his issue. You know,
he's blah, a psycho.
Yeah. Well, but Herzog, the way he interprets it, and I wonder if he actually believes this or if he was doing this for creative reasons. Herzog literally bases it on the premise, no, he wanted to be a bear. But if you think about it, whether that's true or not, and I lean towards this guy was probably an adrenaline junkie, the whole existentialist approach that Herzog takes of this is a man who wanted to be a bear, that's more interesting in a lot of ways than telling the completely accurate story or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, maybe they're both true, right?
In their own way, yes.
Yeah, that they just speak of a different reflection. Right now, maybe if we can quantify this, maybe he only wanted to be a bear in like some sort of perverted 3% way, and that 80% he was adrenaline junkie, and then whatever it was, 14% or whatever's left over, 17% he wanted to be famous. I don't know, whatever. I mean, motivations within humanity are so multifarious that I think that if you highlight one kind of reflection of that, that isn't a distortion of the truth. It's just a particular angle. And I love highlighting those angles. I like exposing those angles because I think they open us up to something more, not just interesting because it's dramatic or something like that, but it opens us up to that which is unsaid, right? That which kind of sits beneath the surface. And that's why I love Herzog's like monotone musings about the alligators at the end of the cave painting film, right? Like he has these fucking random albino alligators that he discovers, and then he starts thinking about how they may have been there when these cave paintings were made or some shit like that, right? Like there's just some interesting view that he has on the world, and he's able to open us up to that. And I think what that does is that opens us up to not being so trapped within certain restrictions of thinking. And I think that a lot of bad politics, I think a lot of bad social interaction comes from certain restricted forms of thinking, or what we could, I think, even say are dogmatic, that ultimately have a kind of like religious dogmatism to them that entrap us within these tiny parameters of thought. But I'm very influenced by the philosopher Gilles Deleuze, and his idea is that there's a big difference between knowledge and thought, and true thought, or what he calls in some of his earlier works, like the image of thought, and then maybe we could call like thinking, right? True thinking is something that is far more expansive, that has to be shocked, that has to be induced from some sort of event, right? Some sort of external thing that like scrambles our codes of normalcy, for lack of a better way of saying it. And I think that thought is something that we don't even really fully grasp yet. I mean, I think it's something that exists beyond what we can do. And that's why I love cinema, is cinema can, not that it does, you know, if you just see some sort of like perfectly packaged and manicured three-act structure film that's telling the same story with just different faces or whatever, that's like a Hollywood vehicle, that might not have the same degree of potency to it. But cinema can speak in a way that is transformative, that is excessive, that is beyond those bounds. And that's the kind of cinema that really gets me excited, even if I do enjoy the rom-com, whatever, now and then.
Well, that's what's so interesting, not just about this experimental documentary, Inventing the Future, this cinematic adaptation, but also the book itself, because one of the things I noticed in the book is that there's a real pushback against this glorification of the folk politics of the 60s that the left took up. And it's asking us to consider different possibilities. And that's something I've always liked about the left. I mean, when I was younger, I, like many a young white male in America, I went through that phase known as being a teenaged libertarian. But the thing was, I was really interested in that idea of freedom and liberty. And I think ultimately that's what brought me to the left, because I think the leftist project is ultimately one of emancipation, more so than the sort of right-wing libertarianism of, say, like the Von Mises Institute or right-wing libertarians. I think the true seekers of liberty end up being on the left. I think there's this desire for emancipation from dogmatic systems or systems that don't allow us to express ourselves to the fullest extent possible.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely one story that you can tell of the left that goes back to the Jacobin revolt, and what you get in France is a conception of what is sometimes referred to in philosophy of negative freedom. Freedom from the state, or freedom from the monarchy, and freedom from the church, right? So freedom from God, freedom from some sort of transcendent others that are telling us how to behave. And so what you get is a sort of freedom from those things, a rejection of those things that can open up the potential potency of new forms of emancipatory social living, right? The question is you get like the anarcho-capitalist and the libertarian notion that one fetishizes this negative form of freedom to, I think, the neglect of another type of freedom that Isaiah Berlin identifies as like positive liberty, which is something important to consider, not just what you're free from, but what are you free for, right? But also I think that there's something that's missing in a lot of these libertarian notions, which is that they presume a certain what we might call a priori metaphysic of the self, right? It starts from the pre-constituted individual, that is the site of some sort of natural and essential site of where freedom plays out. And so really all you need to do is preserve that freedom of the self from external influences that would coerce or corrupt or negatively influence decision-making and thoughts and actions and things like that. And so the question is do we accept that as the starting point, as the foundation? I mean, it is kind of like the bedrock assumption within libertarian theses. And I think that some people on the left, you know, you get more like left anarchists, right? Or left libertarians, sometimes it's called. But anarcho-communists or post-structuralist anarchists and stuff like that, that they still want to think about, you know, freedom from the state or freedom from corrupting institutions, freedom from the corrupting party, something like that. Because they still realize a similar type of vision that I think can be traced back to that kind of like Jacobin philosophy, which is freedom from these institutional corruptions, church or state or, you know, the nuclear family or whatever, something along those lines. And so there are different ways of expressing that. And then, of course, there's like a more proper communist or socialist post-capitalist vision that is also emancipatory, but I think that has some sort of similar thread, precisely as you just said. Being concerned eminently with emancipation. The whole project of Marx's Critique of Political Economy that then you could trace all the way back to the Communist Manifesto that he writes with Engels is primarily concerned with how to free people, if you will, from the constraints of bourgeois political economy, the capitalist system that creates a particular society of social domination. And how do we break free from that? Obviously, they advocate for a different project than anarchists, and then, of course, from like, you know, libertarian and ANCAP types. But nevertheless, there is a fundamental concern here with freedom that that kind of drives a lot of these political projects. It's just they're expressed in various ways.
Well, I was going to mention, too, even when you look at, you know, one of these libertarian thinkers, like the one that comes to mind is von Mises. I mean, there's treatises by von Mises that you can read. Where, I mean, he sort of accepts that there's a natural order with regards to things like gender roles. And this is just the way it is. And he fits it into his idea of how economics works. And it's very, very limiting. Like, I think there's different types of freedom, too. Like, we don't have freedom in regards to how we can express ourselves culturally. When it comes to things like how do you express yourself as a man or a woman or queer or, you know, there's a lot of limitations that are placed on us by the cultural forces at work. And I think that often gets ignored.
Yeah, I mean, that's my big contention with my libertarian friends and my ANCAP friends. I do have friends who write actually for the Mises Institute and that work in that world. And I think that they just have a fundamental misunderstanding of humanity, there's no theory of the unconscious. Everything for them kind of exists at what I would see as being more superficial conception of reality. They kind of just accept a common sense understanding of self and common sense understanding of social relations. Whereas I think the more radical liberatory projects are skeptical of those assumptions, right? I mean, whether it's Foucault and an analysis of like biopolitical management, or whether it's kind of Marxist understandings of the discrepancies between property power, right? Who owns the means of production? Who doesn't? Who are the inputs for capitalist society? Who benefits? Who doesn't? Things like that. Those are things that oftentimes go ignored. And I think it's because there's, again, this assumption that the individual is naturally in itself already a good, right? Is already free. And all we need to do are allow that those freedoms, those expressions of individuality to have the best and the most intense expression of themselves as possible, right? And then, of course, for Mises and for anarcho-capitalists, they just think that the market is the perfect site that induces that level of individual freedom, because you have individuals who can go to the market in exchange for in their freedom, exchange goods and participate in deliberation and haggling and things like that. But they don't understand what I would consider as being like determinant factors prior to that. Like what forces somebody to the market? Like what brings somebody to the market? Well, it's the fact that they don't have access to the means of subsistence. They can't, you know, they can't eat, they can't clothe themselves and they can't house themselves. So they have to sell their labor so that they can go to the market, right? So there are just certain pre-existing factors, pre what we would call like social, determinant social factors that I think are oftentimes ignored by libertarian types. So then the real issue is freedom would then be freedom from those determinant social conditions to create different social determinant conditions, because there are always social conditions that determine how we comport in and to society. It's always existed this way, even in like gift economy exchange, right? There's always some sort of set of a priori categories that are framing how it is we speak and how we relate to people. The question is can we create those forms of social mediation that aren't dominated by the abstract principles of a system of exploitation? That's the real issue, I think, for like the post-capitalist project.
Well, with regards to inventing the future, one of the main topics of interest when talking about Nick Cernicek's work and Alex Williams' work is this idea of universal basic income and also full automation. Yeah. Now, I may have listeners that are unfamiliar with those ideas, although I think in general people understand now what UBI is with, you know, Andrew Yang and whatnot. What do you make of UBI and full automation? Do you think these issues are maybe overstated, understated? Where do you think we're headed?
Yeah, so for people who aren't familiar with the book is really divided into two parts, and the film kind of follows along that. The first part is, as you mentioned earlier, Joe, a critique of folk politics, or like what we might call localism or horizontal or micro politics, right? Which is just the sufficiency, not the necessity, but the sufficiency of the protest or like eating local or eating organic or being involved in kind of like micro political actions of transformation of the body that you get in like post-Foucauldian theories of subjectivity and stuff. And they kind of critique that and they say the left is gotten too embedded with this folk political thing, right? They say what we actually need to do are develop what they call counter-hegemonic strategies. The idea being that capitalism is a hegemonic logic. It is a type of universal abstraction. It's historically contingent, right? But it's a type of abstraction that frames a particular set of thinking and action and social relations, et cetera, that are all conditioned by the logics of capital. Right? The logics of this exploitative system. So everything then is converted into an input for the furtherance of this hegemonic logic, right? So they said we need to develop counter-hegemonic logics. That's the way to kind of break, if you will, the stranglehold of capital. So then the second half of the book goes through these four demands that they think are speculative proposals, not like absolute certainties that we are the cure, right? It's not pitched like that. But they're speculative proposals. And one is full automation. One is a UBI. One is diminishment of the work week. And then the last one is the eradication of the Protestant work ethic. So I think the four of them kind of work together in a particular logical chain. And so the demand for full automation is basically based on this idea that human labor is currently captured under the reproductive capacities of capitalism to reproduce capitalist society in such a way that advocating for a universal basic income would fundamentally contest the wage labor relation within capital, right? So that's why UBI is important. Now, the other reason that this is important is because what we have are technologies that can now displace workers. Technologies can basically, and this is a tendency that you see, I mean, there's obviously discrepancy on how to interpret this, but that workers are perpetually displaced through like outsourcing, but also through technological development, right? That labor is being pushed into, being pushed out of the game, and machines are able to do things more efficiently, and they can intensify production rates, right? So then the question is, okay, so if that's the case, then that's another reason why we need that UBI, because that UBI then would, one, fundamentally contest the wage-labor relation, because people then wouldn't be dependent on selling their labor in order to have access to the means of subsistence to survive. But also, it's going to be kind of necessary because technology is already displacing workers anyway. So what they advocate is, well, maybe we can think about advocating for full automation, which doesn't mean that like literally everything that exists, like in some kind of Wall-E world where we just sit in chairs and drink soda and kind of fly around and everything is taken care of us, but that the basic necessities of human life are taken care of by machines. That's food production. That would be like domestic work. It could also be with regards to like transportation needs and things like that, that they would all be taken over by machines so that you wouldn't have, which are all huge employers of labor. And so when you do that, then you would actually have a displacement of a workforce, but a displacement of a workforce from under the conditions of capitalist reproduction and capitalist exploitation. And then you offer the UBI, because then the UBI allows them to survive and have access to the means of subsistence. So it is a qualitative shift that fundamentally contests the way that capital reproduces itself by reproducing labor as labor is invested in selling its labor into these jobs that they think could be better served by technological expressions. So that's kind of the importance there. Now, do I think this is absolutely happening, like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and fucking Charles Murray and the kind of like conservative idea of technology that then they advocate for a UBI as well? Of course, that's more of a nefarious advocacy for a UBI.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I know Charles Murray has talked about UBI, and I think Thomas Friedman, Milton Friedman was a supporter of it. And the Murray thing,
helicopter money and stuff. Yeah.
The Murray thing bothers me because Murray is like, well, we could get rid of the welfare state and just give these people UBI. And I think to myself, I mean, I'm assuming you've heard of the marshmallow test. Everyone always talks about the marshmallow test. And, you give the kid one marshmallow now, or you tell them, oh, you can get two if you wait for an hour. But what they've found now is that the kids that come from less materially well-off backgrounds, they're not going to wait for it because they don't know if they're going to get the second marshmallow in an hour. So the idea of delayed gratification, it's a learned skill in a lot of ways. We're taught that. So for me, when Murray advocates for UBI, I'm just thinking to myself, you know, if delayed gratification is a learned skill, then how will this affect people when you just sort of give them this money and, you know, they don't know what to do with it immediately?
Yeah, and I have some worries about UBI too. I think that one of the potential concerns is that, let's say that a UBI is placed in the United States tomorrow, and it's above the poverty line. It's like $2,000 a month or something like that, right? And what you end up getting is potentially an entire segment of society that are pacified through consumption. So they just become consumers at that point. But then at the same time, what you have is the perpetual expansion of asset price inflation and digital platforms that are exponentially increasing their valuation on the stock market and in the asset economy. And they're still going to be able to extract their data, because what you're going to have is a group of people who are still consuming media. They're still on the social media platforms. They're still investing a type of, let's say, attention labor. So there's like an attention economy here as well, into these assets that are going to be able to perpetually raise and exponentially raise their valuation on the market, right? And so then the problem is okay, but then what you just have are a group of people that are basically functioning like batteries, but they're given what? Access to food and basic provisions for social reproduction. So that's one of my concerns with a UBI. I don't think it is the answer. The issue is there something fundamentally transformative about basic incomes and the discourses surrounding basic incomes that is qualitatively other, right? That is qualitatively other than the reproductive mechanisms of capital. And that's what I think is important. This is kind of a speculative move rather than more of an empirical one, but it's speculative and I think interesting, because that's really what the issue of contesting capitalism comes down to, is finding the choke points. Is it in the battle between wages and capital, as has historically kind of dominated things, you know, a more just distribution of the value that is produced by the workers, that is supposed to be then a return back to the workers? That's how generally a lot of working class struggle has been pitched or framed historically. Is that an adequate endeavor? I'm not saying that it's not necessary, but is it completely adequate and sufficient? Some authors would argue no. And what I wonder is if there isn't space for us to think about UBI within that framework of thinking that, well, maybe the battle just between over like just wages and the kind of distributional strategies of the working class is insufficient, because it doesn't fundamentally contest the mechanisms of capital's own capacity for reproduction. And that maybe something like a UBI, whether or not it is the sufficient answer itself, which I don't think it is, but it might be some sort of speculative proposal that stimulates our thought in particular directions. And that's what's useful about UBI for me, right? Is, I mean, the people like Zuckerberg and Musk and Charles Murray that want to dismantle the welfare state and advocate for some sort of technological utopia, they're doing so because they have their own bad faith desires, because they know that they're just going to increase their millions or their billions. I don't know about Charles Murray, what his wealth is, but you know, people like Musk and Zuckerberg, they're going to be stoked because they're going to be these new feudal lords that are basically running the digital spaces in which we live. So they love that shit. So I can see the pitfalls in that direction. But that doesn't negate the fact that there might be something interesting, speculatively, theoretically, about helping us understand those choke points that contest capital's reproduction of itself. And that's why I find UBI so interesting.
I also wanted to clarify, in case, I think my words could be misinterpreted, what I said earlier about delayed gratification and UBI. I'm not trying to say that people that don't have a higher income or like these, you know, they just can't resist their urges to
impulse control or something. Right.
I'm not making any kind of moral judgment, but I think there is a psychology, and I think it's separate from any type of morality. When you're deprived of material resources for a long time and you finally have those resources, I think you're going to spend quicker. I mean, that's been my experience when I've gone through dry spells. So I just want to make sure everyone understands I'm not making some kind of moral judgment there.
No, of course. I mean, it's a very rational decision. If you don't know where your next meal is coming from, and a meal then is provided to you, and someone says, yeah, don't do it, you're going to be like, fuck you. It's a very rational decision. It's not impulse control. It's not an issue of impulse control. It's you making the calculated decision that, hey, motherfucker, based in my history, I don't know where my next meal is coming from. If I have an opportunity to satisfy my hunger, fuck yeah, I'm going to take advantage of that. To me, it's eminently rational. It's a rational decision or a rational orientation based on the world that has constituted you in a particular set of ways. So then the issue is, okay, so what does that mean for UBI? If we give everybody a UBI, there might be some growing pains, right? There might be some individuals, some households that are like, fuck, we've got this $2,000. We're just going to go out and buy stuff that is a bit superfluous. But the real issue is, and this is why you have all of these like pilots around the world that have used UBI, right? Is would there be some sort of like long-term set of benefits that would fundamentally transform one, that relation, that wage that capital labor relation that I was talking about earlier. But also, would it not transform how it is that we consume? Would people become more minimal? Would it slow down growth? Would it increase growth? What would it do for kind of creating different segments of the economy? Would it fall into that pitfall that I was talking about earlier, where you get like a hard, fast level of these are just the like inputs and the batteries that are just purely consumers, and then you have like the world of Elysium or something like that, where you have the people that are extracting trillions in like data capital and asset valuation and stuff like that. It could run into that. There's this, it's kind of a contested set of data, but in Canada, they ran a pilot, I believe it was in Manitoba in like the 70s. And there's this, this set of data that says that actually when a UBI was implemented, divorce rates went up because certain women who were in abusive relationships didn't feel that they needed to stay in that household, but they actually were given a measure of like social freedom. Is that something that we would see? They did a UBI, I believe it was in Finland, and it was a short pilot, but nevertheless, they realized that people's sense of well-being and happiness increased. So is that something like mental well-being, because you don't have to worry about where your meal is going to come from? You don't have to worry about whether or not you can turn your lights on. That stress is alleviated. And we know that in children in particular, that when cortisol levels are pumped through the brain because of economic stress and family stress and things like that, that that fundamentally alters their brain chemistry for their lives. So the question is, if we can eliminate that, if we can reduce that, is that a good thing? I mean, these are all things that we need to consider. They're all factors that we would need to consider, both the good and the bad, I think, when we're talking about these things.
No, I agree 110%. And I would say it's a piece of the puzzle if you can get the other pieces incorrectly. You know, I think
yeah.
I'm very interested in the topic of education, because I feel like in a lot of ways, the way the education system is set up as we know it now, it's sort of is set up to sort certain people out. And yeah. It's also set up to teach certain people that have more material advantage, the behaviors that are going to get them ahead in their sort of class status, their class position. I would like to see something like education equalized in addition to these things like UBI. I think there's different levels, there's different layers and different areas that we have to attack, and UBI is one of those.
I agree. It can be one of them, exactly. And you know what? It might be the sort of thing where we realize, fuck, it wasn't a good idea. You know, like it wasn't the best thing to do. The issue is it comes down to like desirability. Is this something that we desire? Feasibility. Is this something that we can do? And if so, then we have to figure out, okay, how can we implement it? Right. And that's the real issue is this something desirable? Well, there's still debate about that. Right. Is this something that's feasible? Well, there's definitely a lot of debate about that. Is it affordable? Can we actually do it? Can we afford it? And these are things that a lot of people are engaging in, and there's a lot of literature out there to wade through, and there's a lot of debate that's ongoing. But I think that's really the issue that we need to think about. And I do think, at the very least, speculatively, it is desirable, at least to consider. It is something that we ought to muse about, engage with, debate, and I'd maybe even run more pilots and experiments to see what type of effects it does produce. And I think we really need to also be willing to modify our positions on things. Like, we might advocate for a basic income, but then does it end up being that, well, actually we should advocate for universal basic services, which is free education, free healthcare, free domestic care, free child care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so like maybe that's where we end up coming out on the other side. But at the very least, I think we should be willing to have these discussions.
Yeah, I think we have to be flexible. We have to understand that we're sort of in what Zygmunt Bauman called liquid modernity. And we have to be flexible. Yeah. We have to know how to navigate the storm, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something really powerful about the imagination's ability to speculate and craft alternative worlds. And I don't just mean this in some sort of like naive utopian sense, right? But rather, what I make a distinction in my book, actually, that I wrote on the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre and the imagination and stuff like that, is what I make a distinction between is what like a utopian image is and then a utopic type of thought. And a utopic type of thinking is one that thinks beyond the present state of affairs, right? That is unwaveringly imaginative and unwaveringly inventive and creative, right? The question is how to do that and under what conditions can we do that? Like, can we do that outside of the capitalist imaginary? And I think there are ways to do that. And I think that that's where like UBI and thinking about these various proposals, full automation come in as these really useful speculative proposals that can shock us into thought, that can orient us in the world in different ways, that can help us to see the world in different ways as they sort of like redouble on us, as we're projecting these images as theoretical kind of apparatuses, as tools, as thought experiments, that can help us in our political and social and personal and own psychological lives as we're trying to kind of like confront the world and figure out how to change the world for the better. And I don't think it necessarily means some sort of like utopianism, because what if the future that you're projecting isn't some sort of like fixed teleological end, but rather is precisely that, I mean, Nick and Alex refer to it as a hyperstitional image. It's a type of image that is a performative, right? That's what they call it in the book. But it's used as a type of placeholder, an empty placeholder that motivates us, that stimulates, that affects us, you know? And that's where I think this stuff is really useful. And I know that people might be listening, they're like, this shit is like utopian mumbo jumbo. And I get it, man. I get it. I think there are elements of utopianism in this. I just don't think that it's necessarily naively utopian.
Is it any worse than what we do now where we assume that getting effective on social media is going to change the world somehow? I mean, it's not that much. I mean, at least Nick and Alex are thinking about things. And I do think there's a use to utopian rhetoric.
Yeah, Sartre talks about how sometimes we craft future images for the sole purpose of arousing the affections. And I love that idea. That sometimes you craft, like, sometimes we all fantasize. But maybe I'm fantasizing about like my future partner or a future job or something. And I use that as something that arouses me to motivate me in the present, right?
Are you familiar with chaos magic at all?
I'm into it, dude. I'm into it. But like, I don't mean like The Secret, like positive thinking and you'll manifest it or some shit like that. I don't quite go to the metaphysics of it. But there is something about meme magic, right? No, there is something about like saying like, I can envision a world where there is racial equality. I can envision a world where there's gender equality. I can envision a world where there's trans rights. And in envisioning that world and in participating with others who envision that world, doesn't that create some sense of solidarity in the present to try to realize that vision? And then once we start to make steps towards that vision, then don't we start to say, oh, well, here's another voice that we've excluded, animal rights or something like that, right? Or here's another group of oppressed people, or here's another voice that hasn't informed that previously constituted image that now we can use to reconstitute that image by being a little bit more sensitive, more pluralistic, or more adequate to the data and the facts that we receive as we march towards those images. So that's the idea, is it's this perpetual reordering and then projecting and then reordering and then projecting of these images, but nevertheless use them to motivate us to realize them, or use them to motivate us to actualize them. And then, of course, this is an endless process, right? This isn't that there's a fixed end. That would be utopian. But that nevertheless, there's a comportment towards potential. And that's what I think inventing the future is about. It's about being comported to the openness of this thing that we call the future. Not a pre-constituted, absolute, prefigured future, but being open to the fact that there's more than what's present and there's more than what's past. And I think that's what's really cool to think about.
Now, before I let you go, I just wanted to have a brief discussion, if we could, about one more aspect of the movie and book that interested me. Okay, awesome. So one of the things that really intrigued me about Inventing the Future, Nick and Alex's work, this documentary, is especially in the book, and I know you cover it in the documentary as well, it talks a lot about the need to diminish the work ethic. And I have to say, I've always been very interested in the work of Max Weber. And I know he's not a Marxist. So I have Marxist listeners that are just like, oh, Weber. But Weber's whole thing about the Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism, to me, it's like some type of horror story. Even the imagery he uses at times of, you know, capitalism in the iron cage, it's very powerful stuff. And I think there is something really insidious about this sort of Protestant work ethic. Like you constantly have to be productive. I mean, I even see it with leftists and people like myself. And I think this is part of the logic of the culture that neoliberalism breeds, this idea that we always have to be productive. Oh, you know, you took a break one day and just sort of lounged about and vegetated. That's awful. And you feel unproductive and you feel bad about yourself. And there's something really insidious and sinister about that. So inventing the future, sort of taking that on, I found very powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, here's the thing. I think when we're attacking the Protestant work ethic, it's extremely important to realize that we're not attacking creativity. We're not attacking the human desire towards ingenuity or towards invention, obviously, or even towards some notion of productivity. But what the Protestant work ethic, or what attacking the Protestant work ethic is doing, is it's confronting a particular type of productivity, that productivity that you just talked about, that guilt that comes because we haven't been faithful subjects of the neoliberal demand to consume, to produce, to be positive, to participate, to sell our labor, etc., etc. Right?
There's a critical theorist, and I'm blanking on his name. I always mispronounce it. But he wrote a book called The Burnout Society.
Yeah, that's Byung-Chul Han. That's who I was talking about earlier. When I talked about the culture of pure positivity, Byung-Chul Han. And yeah, go ahead. Did you like Burnout Society?
Well, I thought it was fascinating. And I think it sums up what this culture of neoliberal demands for hyper-productivity have led to. I mean, we're sort of being reduced to these machines that constantly have to work, produce. And it's creating burnouts.
Well, and even when we're not working in the formal sense, you're working in the informal sense. You're scrolling on Instagram. And for every second of time and attention and energy that you expend on Instagram, that goes towards increasing Instagram's valuation on the bond market or on the credit market or in the capital markets. So not on the bond market. In the credit markets, well, maybe the corporate bonds. But so that it can court more investment as its valuation increases because it has more users, because it has people who spend more time. It has people who like more, they engage more. They're clicking on advertisements more, whatever it is. So there's a sense in which we need to start thinking seriously and materially about the attention economy, about the libidinal economy, about how our desire is being induced, if you will, into this perpetuation of these machines, of these platforms, of these mechanisms, of these institutions, for the purpose of extracting data, for the purpose of extracting capital that they then can assetize and, you know, trade for billions and billions and billions of dollars. And what this does is this kind of induces in us a set of demands that we actually need to participate more. And it kind of leads to us being not complicit in the sense, this isn't a moral judgment, this is more of an analytical judgment, but we'll become complicit, if you will, in our own kind of like intensified anxious anxiety within this same culture of reproduction of capital and data assets and things like that. So yeah, it does burn us out. It does fucking burn us out because we don't ever stop. Jonathan Crary wrote a book called 24/7 for people who are interested. And it's the idea that fuck, even when we're sleeping, my online persona is accumulating capital, right? As it's engaging with other people. Something that I said at 3 o'clock in the afternoon is still, quote, being said at 2 o'clock in the morning on Twitter or Insta or whatever. And there's a sense in which we don't ever really fully get to unplug from this system of capital accumulation. And that, I think, does lead to a burnout. It does. It is fucking exhausting. And then we buy into it and we think that we can find like some kind of salvation through it, right? That like, if I can just find my place in the midst of all this frenetic perpetual motion, then I might be able to find some semblance of enjoyment. But I think that that actually just ultimately does a disservice to us. And what we really need to start doing is thinking about ways to fundamentally break that trajectory, to break those things. The word kairos comes to mind in the ancient Greek, and you get thinkers like Benjamin and Derrida who talk about this, but it's like a qualitative other temporality, a season or an age or an opportune moment to kind of transform, if you will, the flow of things that are moving in one particular trajectory and to transform that and to break with that sort of temporal horizon. And I think that is so important to think about because otherwise the mechanisms of enclosure are just too strong and too powerful. And I think ultimately they lead to us being these really stressed out, anxious, superficial, shallow, and impotent. And I mean impotent in the sense of being able to transform society, and we become impotent subjects. And I think that that is really frightening to me.
It's interesting you mentioned that book 24/7. I have it lying around my place somewhere. I have to get it out of the boxes one of these days and give it another read.
It's great.
It's about the sort of war against sleep almost.
Yeah, no, literally. That's the whole idea, is like that no matter what, like even when you're asleep, you're still producing, you know? And that's frightening to me. That is absolutely frightening to me. And I don't think it's not just some theoretical thing either. I think Crary presents some really compelling arguments in there that really make you think that, fuck, we don't ever turn off. We're plugged into the matrix, baby. Fuck.
You know what really scares me is Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post fame actually made like a similar argument. Oh, we're too overworked. We don't get enough sleep. But she made the argument in service of capitalism, where she said we would be more productive if we were less overworked and we got more sleep. So this is actually good for capitalism. Like, she took the 24/7 McCrary argument and turned it in service of capitalism.
Well, Marx actually makes this argument about there being a point of diminishing returns, right? Like for the workday, for example. You can't work people 17 hours a day because at some point it's their output is going to diminish. So that's why you have different shifts, right? And so if you can get full productivity for 10 hours, then you can just run these like, you know, perpetual 10 or 8 hours, even then you get 3 8-hour shifts in a day, right? So you can just be perpetually running these 8-hour shifts, or you can be perpetually running 2 12-hour shifts so that the machines are still going, production is still going, but the rate of production doesn't diminish. And so, yeah, it's the fight over energy, the fight over our actual capacity and our power, our biological capacity as living entities is something that is part of this larger struggle.
It's interesting too, and this will be the last note I make on this conversation. I have a deep interest in Japan right now. And it's not like some weeaboo, like I love anime type thing, but just the things like the suicide forest reports of, you know, people literally dying of exhaustion from work, because it's sort of a workaholic culture as far as I can tell. And also just, if you read Fukuyama's The End of History, which I know a lot of people crap on, but at the end of that book, he's looking at Japan and saying, oh, there's these problems now where men are having issues finding a mate. And he's saying this in the 90s. And I'm thinking to myself, that's what's happening now with these, you know, kids that are calling themselves incels. And it seems like Japan has a very interesting place within the global capitalist system. And I sometimes wonder if they're, you know, 10 years ahead of us in some ways.
I got a buddy who made a joke / offhand remark, but I think there's something really powerful in this. He said, we oftentimes look at like the apocalypse and post-apocalyptic landscapes, and we look at films like Mad Max, or you look at novels and films like The Road, you look at like The Walking Dead, stuff like that, where it's just this barren return back to like brute survival, right? Like a reduction to the Hobbesian state of nature or some shit like that. He said, but actually, we actually have an historical example that we're currently living in of a post-apocalyptic society. He said, it's fucking Japan. Two atomic bombs were dropped on this country in the 1940s. He's like, and now 70 years later, 80 years later, we have this society that is different. It isn't some sort of like retreat back into a Hobbesian state of nature. It's this radical technological dystopian world where you like sleep in this pod after working for 16 hours a day, just so you can just get enough sleep to wake up and plug yourself back into your data entry job or whatever it is. Now, obviously that's a bit of a generalization. I know not all of Japanese society is like that, but you do have things like The Lost Generation, right? Like the film Battle Royale is about this, right? You could look at films like Akira that kind of bespeak of some of the tensions within the economic anxieties and stuff that have taken place within Japan. There's a lot of really interesting critical engagement and cultural engagement with Japan post nuclear bombs being dropped on them that helps us think that, man, there is some interesting way that societies respond to trauma, whether it's collective trauma or some sort of like catastrophe, like militaristic catastrophe. I don't know if it's a joke that we actually do have a post-apocalyptic society and it's fucking Japan, or if it's like, if there's something theoretical with like some sort of like teeth that we can chew on there. But he made the remark and it's kind of always stuck in my head.
Well, even if you look at Hong Kong with, you know, I mean, the protests, I completely understand them. I mean, there's the coffin homes now, as they call them. It's, you know, it's kind of horrifying.
What are the coffin homes? Are these like little fucking...
They're like really, really tiny. Square foot? Yeah, yeah. It's really tiny living spaces. I kind of wonder if people have that already here in the U.S. in San Francisco, because I've heard some horror stories about people trying to go to the Silicon Valley to achieve their dreams, and they're working in, or they're living in, you know, closets essentially. And I'm like, this, oh, it's so freaky.
$3,000 a month for a fucking walk-in closet. Your toilet is, you got to piss out the window or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I'm into tiny homes, but I'm not sure about the coffin home thing.
Well, hey, Austin, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. I want to give you a chance to promote Inventing the Future, a cinematic adaptation. How can my listeners watch the experimental documentary that you and Isaiah have done? And also, what do you hope that folks get out of it?
Well, where you can find it is, we just decided to release it on YouTube rather than rely on the gatekeepers of the festival world, who are kind of the gatekeepers of the neoliberal cinematic model, which both of us have films that have gone through that world. We decided that this was always a film that was funded by the people. We got funding through the government. We did an initial crowdfunding campaign. We got funding by the government in Canada. This was always funded by the people. We wanted to just fucking release it for free. So it's on YouTube. So you can just go to YouTube and Google, or just search Inventing the Future. You can also go to Quantity Cinema. That's Isaiah's production company. You can go to Quantity Cinema and you can actually download the file. So we've released the file for free too. So you can fucking cut it up and experiment with it and do your own little meta-modern montage-y thing with it yourself, because this is truly a sort of like releasing of a public entity. So it is completely open source. So you can check that out. And what do I hope people get out of it?
I wanted to say real quick, the fact that you released it in an open source type of way, it reminds me, you know, one thing that I noticed a lot of leftists and libertarians have in common is a lot of them oppose intellectual property.
Yeah. I mean,
that's another story for another time.
It is definitely another story. Yeah. I mean, I still, you know, part of me in my heart of hearts, I still enjoy the acclaim that you get from going to a festival, because your films get reviewed and shit like that. It makes you feel good, right? So I get it when people want to engage in that, but there is something so freeing about having total control over the release of a film like this. And it was like, for me, the producer, right? It was nerve-wracking when we were like, is this what we're going to do? And then we did it, and I actually got like teary-eyed, and I felt like, it might sound cheesy and shit and sentimental, but I felt like we were part of something bigger than us. And it was great. It was the best decision that we ever could have made. So I'm really glad we did that. What do I hope people get out of the film? I almost don't even want to say what I hope people get out of the film. I hope they just get something out of the film. I hope that some people are infuriated by it. I hope some people love it. I hope some people are provoked by it. I hope some people are courted to come back and watch it multiple times. I've watched it multiple times and I get something different, because it moves fast, right? Those images move fast, and the audio moves fast, and it's warping things. And I hope that people get on repeated viewings, that they have different angles and different takes, and that they engage and that they share it with their friends, and that somehow, in some way, to whatever degree, that this film can shock people to thought, that it can be part of the participation of the consolidation of working class power against the reproduction of capitalist society. I'm not saying that the film is going to change the world, but if it inspires somebody, if it motivates people, if it entertains you know, some sort of like socialist working group or communist working group, if it entertains them one night while they're drinking beers and having popcorn, then fucking that's great too. So multiple receptions for a film that I think bespeaks of the multiple.
Well, I gotta say, I like that response that you gave, that, you know, you don't want to tell people what to get out of it. It reminds me of David Lynch. I think he said that on multiple occasions. You know, when people ask him, oh, what does Lost Highway mean? Well, what do you think it means? That's the way to be, in my opinion.
Yeah, death of the author, man. Death of the author.
Also, how can my listeners check out Owls at Dawn and The Wisecrack?
Yeah, I mean, so you can find me on Twitter, personally on Twitter is Austin_Hayden. You can find me on Insta, AUS_HAY. And then I co-host the podcast. It's a philosophy, politics, culture podcast with my buddy, one of my best friends, Troy Polidori. It's called Owls at Dawn. You can find us on Twitter, owls_at_dawn, or you can just find us on all the different like various podcast outlets. We've been going for like 4 years, and you know, we do like topical shit, but we also do some heavy philosophical lifting as well, where we do like a book club where we go through a pretty dense text and we try to present that to an audience that it can be heavy sometimes, but we try to make it so that it's presented to an audience that aren't necessarily academic philosophers. So you can check that out. And then I co-host the Wisecrack Show Me the Meaning podcast. And again, it's Wisecrack's YouTube channel. So if you know them, they have a podcast called Show Me the Meaning. Just find it on all the podcast outlets as well.
Well, thank you again, Austin Hayden, for coming on Parallax Views.
Yeah, thanks so much, brother. Appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Austin Hayden, and I highly recommend checking out the documentary Inventing the Future, a Cinematic Adaptation, available now free of charge on YouTube. So just type in Inventing the Future, it will come up, and I assure you, it's a rather interesting work. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Also, we're living in some pretty wild times, at least here in America right now, and I just want to say that I hope all of you are staying safe. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views. With Parallax Views. To Parallax Views. With Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.